On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, I'm Chow Tu, and today I'm giving you a preview of the Slate Plus bonus episodes we've been making all season for Slow Burn. In each episode, I've chatted with host Joel Anderson and producer Christopher Johnson about the making of the series, and we dig more into some of the stories and themes that they couldn't cover in the main episodes. Then we get to hear extended interviews with some of the significant players from the time, people who really knew Tupac and Biggie, who experienced everything in real time, and who provide more insight and background to the story, including one of Tupac's personal attorneys, some of the journalists who interviewed Tupac and Biggie during their feud, and others who became experts on the two rappers and the whole culture and scene of the time. If you're a fan of the season of Slow Burn, you'll really enjoy going more in depth with these bonus episodes. And you should know that the series would not be possible without the support of Slate Plus members. So sign up today and show your support. It's only $35 for the first year, and you won't hear any ads on any Slate podcast. You can sign up now at slate.com/slowburn. Okay, here's your preview. This first clip comes from our first bonus episode, where we get to hear some background on Joel and Christopher themselves. And we get to hear from Sean Holly, an attorney to the stars who once represented Tupac, and who got to see a fun and personal side to the rapper.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to introduce you guys a little bit. Can you talk a little bit more about your backgrounds and what you guys have worked on?
Yeah, well, I am originally from Houston, Texas, went to college at Texas Christian University, go Frogs, and have worked all around. My background is mostly in print or online, so I started the Associated Press, Shreveport Times, Tampa Bay Times, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Tampa Bay Times again. Then I moved to New York in 2013 to work for BuzzFeed. And that's kind of where, you know, a lot of things really took off for me. I was sort of a national news correspondent. So I covered like Ferguson and the Baltimore uprising, a lot of that stuff there. And that just was like a lot of work that got a lot of attention. I was like, yo, like my career was built on like tragedy in some ways. And so I thought I'd be really thoughtful about the work I do and like not, you know, just know that like, this could have been anybody. Anybody else could have got assigned to those stories. I just happened to have gotten it. So anyway, after that, I got burnt out and decided I wanted to cover college football for 2 years at ESPN. And then Slate came to me with this opportunity.
Can I say something right quick?
Of course.
This dude is being ridiculously humble, which is it was consistent.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember when I first was looking into taking this position and working with you and, of course, did my background research and I found the story that you did. We talked about it on the phone, your story about Jabbar during Katrina, right? So tragedy. But the way that you told that story told me everything I needed to know about, like, my trust for you handling this kind of a story, right? So handling the story that we're working on now, that it wasn't going to be a sensational project. And certainly the editors have control over that, but the host also, in my experience anyway, does have a lot of say-so,
right,
as he or she should, in driving the direction and the voice and the tone and the way that you treated the experience of that black man in the middle of this like legal and weather, not even really weather, but like this chaos. You know, told me a lot of the stuff I needed to know. So,
oh, man, Chris is being much too kind, and I'm gonna wait for him to say what his background is before I.
And they do the same thing to me.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's hear it, Christopher.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in and out of Washington, D.C., between D.C. and Montgomery County. I grew up on go-go and D.C. punk and 80s R&B and soul music. Yeah, my mother's fried chicken. I mean, that's what raised me. And I went to Rutgers University, and then I went on to grad school. I'm kind of, in my previous life, an academic, a PhD dropout, that kind of stuff. Dropped out and went to work for NPR. My first media gig was at NPR in D.C.
Nice.
I was a producer, kind of your like grunt producer at Morning Edition. I did that and then went out to NPR West in L.A., started a couple shows out there day to day, and then News and Notes, which was NPR's black show the black show.
Pogrom.
Pogrom. I did that for a while, and then I decided to go freelance and move to Southeast Asia for a little while and live there and bounced around. And then came back to the States and conceived and wrote this podcast called 100 to 1, The Crack.
My name is Sean Holly. I am a partner at Kinsella Weitzman Iserkump and Aldisert, which is an entertainment litigation and business litigation firm in Santa Monica. I worked at Johnny Cochran's office for a long time. I was part of the O.J. Simpson defense team, and I started out my career as a Los Angeles County public defender, and I consider myself a public defender at heart.
At this point, you know, 2019, you have sort of the distance to be like, well, there is this perception of Tupac as like a one-man crime band or, you know, whatever. But at the time, when you get a call from a national legal coordinator, and I'm assuming you'd heard of Tupac just via movies, music, whatever, like what were sort of your perceptions of him before you'd even had a chance to meet him? And then you get this call.
I don't know that I had any perception of him in particular. I don't think that I thought he was bad, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, he was coming to me through someone who obviously was shepherding out a whole bunch of cases that he had. I don't think that that caused me to, you know, make any presumptions about him. But I'm pretty sure that I met him shortly after that. Whatever I would have thought would have immediately gone out the window, because there was like no more amazing, brilliant, charming, fabulous person than he. So Whatever you might have thought, you know, if it was bad, you wouldn't think that anymore.
Wow. Well, can you tell me what you remember that first meeting and sort of the circumstances of it? Did he come to your office, or did you go to meet him, or how did that work?
He came to the office. He was one of these people who, you know, almost is like glowing. They're so special, you know, and was just incredibly charming and, you know, a little flirtatious, which wasn't a bad thing either. But I think that we just kind of went through the cases. I think that there were probably a couple that were pending at that time that I was going to be dealing with. And, you know, it's so crazy when I think about that time, because it's so different now, my practice, when I'm representing celebrities. I mean, there has to be like an entire plan as to how to get in and out of wherever you're going. I mean, there's just so, this was, you know, before TMZ or any of that. So, I mean, I could like meet him at the place where his deposition was going to be taken, which might be some office in Century City, you know, right outside the office building at like the grassy area. You know what I mean? Like, it's just crazy when I think about that, because that could never in a million years happen now. I remember one occasion, because he would always be late. And so finally on this one occasion, I'm like, I'm not getting there on time because I'm sick of him being late and me waiting and me admonishing him every time this happens. And then of course, that was the time that he was on time, because he was showing me that he could be on time and then I was late. So I guess in that respect, we were not really in sync.
That's right. Well, wait, yeah. So like, was he alone when you met with him? Because really?
Yeah, no, he would just be alone, which is part of what's so crazy about it. Like I said, that just could not happen now at all, ever.
Well, it, you know what? It doesn't even sound like him either, right? Because having talked to people, it sounded like there were always dudes around, right? Whenever he moved. But on the occasions you were around him, he would just come over by himself.
Yeah. I mean, maybe a dude like, you know, dropped him off somewhere and picked him up somewhere, but where he would be meeting me, he would be like rolling up alone, just walking up.
Crazy.
Which is crazy. Yeah. It's great. Really, what I found with Tupac, and then later, you know, I represented Lindsay Lohan for many years, I saw a similar thing in representing both of them, which is that there would be a perception out in the world that with respect to both of these people, that they are somehow bad actors, but they have a lot of money. So I think that they both, in many respects, were targets for, you know, I was going to say predators, and I could say that, but I'll be a little kinder. People who thought that, you know, this is kind of a perfect opportunity to get something here, because everybody's going to presume that this person, be it Tupac or Lindsay, did whatever it is I'm alleging. And because these people have a lot of money, they'll be willing to write a check to make it all go away.
You know, when we started this project,
This next clip comes from our third bonus episode, which has an interview with the hip-hop journalist Maddie C, who really got to know Biggie after featuring him in his unsigned hype column in The Source. He gets into the dynamic between Biggie and Tupac and the role that hip-hop media played in their feud. So, episode three, this is a pretty big one. We start off where we left off at Quad Studios and Tupac getting shot. And so on the other side, Biggie's been making music, he's been getting some hype, he gets linked up with Puffy. And so after Quad Studios, he releases a song called Who Shot Ya? So there's a lot of ambiguity about whether the song was aimed at Tupac or not. So do we know what people at that time were thinking about that song?
Well, it's important to remember that the beat for Who Shot Ya appeared on Mary J. Blige's album called My Life, which is an album that was released before the Quad shooting. And the beat appears on the song called The K. Murray Interlude. And a song, it's like a 22-second clip of a rapper named Keith Murray just rapping over that beat for Who Shot Ya, right? And so Nasheem Myrick is the producer, and you hear him in this episode talk about making that beat. So he's the one that knows that that beat was made well before the Quad shooting. And at first, you know, Puff wanted Keith Murray to do a longer song over that beat. Didn't work out, as we mentioned in the podcast. And then they tried to bring in LL Cool J, who was supposed to do something with the beat. Puff didn't like that. And so they said, well, hey, what? Let's give it to Biggie. And so Biggie took it and put out the song that we know now is Who Shot Ya. This is all done before the Quad shooting. Mm. The problem was that it got released a few months later after the Quad shooting as a B-side to Big Papa. And so, like, it's hard to argue that the song was made with Tupac in mind. But it's understandable if you think the timing of the release was made with him in mind, too. Like, if you want to be uncharitable and say they released it as a way to taunt Tupac, you could argue that. But the song was not made with Tupac in mind. And so if you were Tupac, you probably would have thought it was about you. It makes sense, right? Like, hey, I thought these guys were the ones that shot me, and now they're taunting me with this song. But I think the general thought around the music industry was that it was either extraordinarily flagrant at best or insensitive at worst.
Could it have been aimed at anybody else?
No, I mean, you know, it's just important to remember. And so Christopher knows because he's steeped heavily in this culture. I mean, man, shooting people in songs is a staple of hip hop. You know what I mean? Like, it's not unusual to, like, talk about, you know, hypothetical violence against random assailants and enemies and haters or whatever. You know what I mean? So I think it's just the timing of it. And because the title just seems like specifically tailored to what happened to Tupac, because there was mystery around it, theoretically, right? They, like, Tupac, who shot you, dude, you know? But, you know, nah, that's just a par for course in hip hop, you know, talking about shooting people, man, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting. This only just occurred to me, but, well, let me just wonder aloud about whether or not in Tupac's music and sort of Tupac's version of hip hop, he's literal in a way that Biggie isn't necessarily literal. Of course, there are songs that are autobiographical, and there's autobiographical elements of Biggie's music, but part of the artistry that is in Biggie's music is not being quite as sort of literal and blunt in his language as Tupac's music is. And I say that really not knowing Tupac's music that well. It may not be true, but what I know of Tupac's music, and it's in fact, like, you know, one of the things I think he's known for is just being very direct. Not that Tupac didn't get that, you know, what hip hop was, and that there's all kind of versions of hip hop along the spectrum of very literal to extremely abstract. But when you're in the kind of vulnerable position that he's in, and he already has these reasons to suspect that these guys might be coming for him,
right,
it's both easy for him to imagine that this might have been directed to him, and also for this to feed his paranoia or his kind of confusion or whatever you want to call it around that time, because it's like just abstract enough for him to just panic, basically, and to sit and sort of worry.
Yeah, we talked about his paranoia in the first episode.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Maddie C, Mateo Capilongo, a.k.a. Maddie C, joined up with the guys at The Source, and eventually you started writing this unsigned hype column, which became really like a kind of this.
This is Maddie C. I am Maddie C. Mateo Capilongo is my full name. Former editor at Source Magazine. The Unsigned Hype column was a column I wrote at Source. And after The Source, I worked A&R at Loud Records.
When did you get a chance to meet him then, Big?
Coincidentally, I moved a block away from him, like within a couple of months, because out of the blue, you know, my friend Chris Wilder, who was at the Source as well, just recommended his spot because it was like nearly half what I was paying in the Lower East Side. And I was like, boom, I'll take it. And it was in a brownstone on Grand and Gates, which is about two blocks away from Big's house. And so a few days after that, I was just walking down the street. Like, yo, we ran into each other. You know what I mean? Yo, you Big? Are you Matt? Oh, boom. Yo, let's go roll something up. We went and hung out. And then, like, pretty much every day after that, I would see him on the way to the train. His block was on the way to the train station. So almost every day on the way to the train or on the way home, we'd bump heads.
Oh, wow. He seems like a sweetheart. Like, he seems like one of the
sweetheart of the block, yeah. It was really an amazing sight to see, you know. Here's this big, dark-skinned, you know, ill-looking dude on the corner. Like, you would think he scares people off the block, when in fact, you see so many people get off the subway and walk by. I'm like, hi, Biggie. All these girls, like, hi, Biggie. Like, you know, he's got this personal thing with each one of them. And you're like, wow. You know, he's just one of those people that just had that couple little lines of small talk that, you know, makes you remember him and just, like, you know, a charisma.
He was a block all-star, basically.
Definitely, man. He was the mayor of the block. Mayor of St. James, for sure.
Wow. So you hadn't written the Unsigned Hype column by this point, right?
I don't think it was published yet, but I probably had written it. He was actually pretty pissed off because I had a line in the article that said his rhymes are fatter than he is. And so he was picking a beef with me, actually, for that line.
Oh, really? What did he say?
Like, yo, what's up with that? Why you have to say that, man? Yo, what the fuck? Yo, what do you call me fat, man? What?
So you write the Unsigned Hype column. It comes out, and, like, you've told the story a million times, but maybe our listeners hadn't heard it. But You get a call from Puffy at Uptown. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the article, I'm not sure, had even come out yet, but I had written it. And I got a call from him. And I knew exactly why, because I also was the news editor, and I also did something for radio called The Weekly Word, where I wrote, like, little blurbs for radio stations nationwide to kind of announce little news items. And one of the news items I had just put out was MCA signed a $50 million deal with Uptown Records. Mm. And this was humongous. Yeah. And even though Uptown was mostly R&B, we knew Puff was there. We knew Father MC. You knew he was a rap. You know, he was a hip hop head, and there was hope. You know, that some big dollars might get thrown at hip hop. You know, and so that was in the back of my head. I must mention.
Oh yeah.
And I knew that was why he called. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yo, what's up? We got some money. Like, y'all got some shit. Like, and I was like, yeah. He was like, come on up.
Huh? So you went and met him up?
I went to his office with the tape. Yep.
Really. Yeah. And what was that like?
First of all, I wasn't let into his office. And it was Kim Porter, actually, that was at the door. Rest in peace. Not letting me in. Then finally, he came, and he was like, no, that's Matty. Yeah, I'll let him in. So he came, got me, and went back there. And Misa was in the office eating sushi. I'll never forget that, too. And I played the demo. And again, my recollection immediately after playing it is him asking me about how he looks. It's a good sign. You know what I mean? He was excited. Like, everybody knew he was the fashion guy. That's what Puff did. He took an artist and he put the right outfit on him and, you know, that style. So he wanted to know what he was working with.
Right.
You know? And I'm not really sure how to answer. I didn't bring a photo. I like to not have the photo. When I listen to demos, I always turn the shit over. I don't want to see a photo. I just want to hear it.
Right.
So I wanted him to have the same experience. I just play it. Now he's got to know how he looks. He keeps pressing me. I'm like, yeah, is he fat? Yeah, he's fat. He's fat. He's like, is he fat boys fat or heavy D fat? I'm like, some in between, maybe. You know, I'm trying to explain it. So this is the conversation that we're having. It's friendly. It's joke.
And finally, we have a clip from our 7th bonus episode, which features an interview with Cheo Hodari Coker, who interviewed Biggie the night before he died and later wrote a biography on him. He talks about what he thinks was in the future for both of the rappers. So there's a sense that in hindsight, Puffy and Biggie's trip to the West Coast was probably a mistake. Like you said, it was about 6 months after Tupac's death. So had things died down by then, or was anything happening in kind of the so-called East versus West feud?
So at this point, Tupac is dead, obviously. Mm-hmm. Suge was sent to jail for violating his parole for participating in that casino beatdown of Orlando Anderson. Like, it violated the terms of his parole for an earlier assault charge. So Tupac's dead. Suge's in jail. Remember, Dre has left death row. Mm-hmm. Snoop is just now, you know, a few months after having been found not guilty on a murder charge. Mm. So in that way, whatever is left of death row isn't much.
Okay.
So it'd be understandable if Puffy and Biggie looked at that and said, hey, things are cool now.
Right.
Things seem to be, you know, moving towards like peace and resolution. And there were even these events that called for an end to violence around that time that was called, as Christopher knows, the Hip Hop Day for Atonement. It was organized in New York by the Nation of Islam. This is like, you know, a few days, maybe a couple weeks after Tupac dies.
Mm-hmm.
And then even a few months later, Snoop and Puffy go on the Steve Harvey Show to basically hug it out and say, hey, we're together. There's no beef. Right. But Nasheem Myrick makes this point, and it doesn't come up in the podcast, but like nobody had really checked to see if the beef was over. You know what I mean? Like nobody, yeah. Like it's still not a lot of time had passed before Biggie and Puffy go on this promo tour of California. And like, what we would say back home is they didn't really give that bitch a chance to breathe. You know what I'm saying? Like, you got to let the bitch breathe. You know what I'm saying? So they like, they go right back out into the middle of this shit. They haven't really tested the waters to know if people are still pissed at them or not.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
Yeah, and one of the things that we've heard from, I think Reggie Wright made this point. He was the head of Death Row Security back in the day. He said that, you know, out of respect and also as a kind of matter of course and to just stay safe, before you go into someone else's town as a crew, you call ahead as a kind, as a show of respect. Yeah. You call them up and let them know, listen, I'm going to be rolling around in your town just so you know.
And everything's chill.
Yeah,
or
and
whatever.
We, you know, maybe we get up. I don't know. I can't say. I don't know if Puffy made that call or not. But it's just a, yet another kind of, I hope that they took that precaution, but I don't know if they did.
Well, you know, so, I mean, this will probably come up later in the podcast, but there are theories, allegations, rumors that Puffy had occasionally enlisted Crips as security. It's like street security in LA.
Mm-hmm.
So like he could have made it okay with them,
right?
But that didn't make, them, that definitely did not make it okay with the Mob Piru if you're rolling with the Southside Crips.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm. And then Biggie releases a song, Going Back to Cali, on his next album. So how did that song come to be? Seems a little bit surprising as Cali anthem.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of thoughts about Going Back to Cali, which probably won't surprise you.
Let's hear it.
So first of all, and Joel, you can check my facts on this, but we spoke with the legendary producer, Easy Mo B, who DJed our launch party, seems like eons ago.
Yeah.
But he... because he'd worked with both artists and tons of other artists, he'd worked with both Tupac and Biggie and had a lot of affection for both of them as creators and as young men. He wanted to make a song that was like, let's squash this. Let's bring the coast together. Let's make a sound that invokes this kind of style that had become popular, at least out of like the death row camp, you know?
Yeah.
And this is like, when we talk about this a little bit in the podcast, this song from the funk group Zap, right? More Bounce to the Ounce. And he's like, that kind of song was like an anthem for those West Coast heads in the way that like Love is the Message by MSFB, I think the group is called, was for us on the East Coast, at least in New York.
Right.
So he's like, I'm going to invoke that West Coast sound. I'm going to make this beat and I'm going to give it to Big and I'm going to let him do something with it.
Hmm.
And if I remember the story right, Big kind of makes the song much faster than Easy Mo B had expected.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh shit. Mo's like, oh shit. I hope that Biggie didn't make something that's going to antagonize the West.
Yeah. Right.
My name is Cheo Hodari Coker. I was the showrunner, executive producer, and creator of Marvel's Luke Cage. But before that, I cut my teeth as a hip hop journalist. I used to write for The Bomb Hip Hop Magazine, Rap Pages, Vibe, The Source, Double XL, and a lot of other publications.
So when you first met him, you talk about meeting him at these three different points in your life, in his life at least. And so like that first time on the stoop on St. James, do you mind sort of painting a picture for us of like who he was and what that was like meeting him for that first time?
It was funny. Okay, so car drops me off right on St. James. And Big is, you know, on his stoop. And he literally is like just kind of holding court. He's just kind of chilling, you know, and we end up talking and we're on St. James. And if you look up the street, you see Fulton Street. You look the other way is another street. Every other car that was passing on Fulton was playing a different track from Ready to Die. I mean, you would think it was like a Biggie theme park. It was crazy because that's how much he was just in the zeitgeist, so to speak, of what was happening. That's where that story came from. Like in the middle of our interview, Trife and Larceny come up to him and try to borrow a gun so that they can rob somebody. And then he says he doesn't know where it is. And as soon as they leave, he's like, I know exactly where the gun is. And he has this whole thing about how it's like he's trying to get these kids from around the way to leave with him as part of his entourage. Because now that he's about to tour and see the world, he's trying to get them out of the craziness of Brooklyn. He was charismatic. I mean, he was cool. He was funny. He was irreverent. He was just as colorful as the rapper whose tape I was obsessed with. And he was proud of the fact that he grew up in Brooklyn. And so when you went to visit him and you would go to St. James, he's right there. You know, it's like, here, I'm not changing for shit, was his mentality at the time.
Given all of that, like Puffy obviously had different instincts for him. So like, what do you think of that partnership? Like what sort of influence, if any, did Puffy have over Biggie in that way?
He loved Puff. I mean, Puff was responsible for changing his life. Puff was responsible for telling him to rhyme about selling drugs instead of actually selling drugs and proving to him that it could be more lucrative to write about it than to actually live it. So he always credited Puff for that. But yeah, there was always a certain kind of disconnect. I mean, like from the standpoint of Big all day could do battle rhymes and didn't necessarily want to do Big Papa, didn't necessarily want Juicy to be his first single. I mean, Big, he probably would have preferred Machine Gun Funk. I mean, because his style at the time was really more, you know, Timberland boots and Carhartt and kind of dark street corner type shit, as opposed to, you know, glossy, let me look good in the club, you know, wearing a suede leather jacket kind of Big Papa video things. Right. Puffy really understood his expertise was giving rhythm and blues hip hop grit, because Puffy didn't invent the R&B hip hop blend. I mean, you would have to really start talking about like Ron G and talk about other people with those early mixtapes that were really the first to kind of blend them. But Puff realized, wait a minute, if I take this formula and I refine it and I kind of create this vibe or this feeling that we're going to call hip hop soul, I can sell more records, because ultimately women are the consumers that are actually buying records, as opposed to their male counterparts who just like listening to records on the radio. So then when it comes to his records and it comes to his first singles, he's like, how do I package Big in a way that makes him appealing to women, makes him appealing to radio, and doesn't necessarily cut his street credibility, but then save the hardcore street records for the B-sides and for the album itself. And that ultimately became, you know, the deal that he and Big made so that everybody was happy. Is that like, if you give me Big Papa, if you give me Juicy, if you give me the single that I can sell to radio, you can always have the B-side. You can go as gangster and as hard as you want. And that's how you get a B-side like Who Shot You. You know, yeah. That's how you get, you know, the Biggie that would show up on mixtapes. Like some of the best Biggie Smalls records aren't official releases. It's those mixtape cameos that he would make. You know, like Real Niggas Do Real Things.